You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
So you're coming here for an event called Polarize, where you're speaking with someone with fairly opposing views to your own. The past few weeks in New Zealand has seen the conversation around free speech, and I'm putting free speech in quotation marks, which we can touch on later maybe, but that free speech has basically erupted here. Could you first explain why exactly you're engaging in a conversation which could be harmful towards certain groups of society in some way and may not reach a consensus? I'm wondering what you're hoping to get out of that conversation.
No, I think I always think it's a good idea to be able to wrestle with folk you disagree with. You can both expose the degree to which they're tied to have truths and even lies, or ways in which your argument and vision can be strengthened. There's a sense in which you are as strong as your critics. And so it's very important that we be able to have some serious and substantive dialogues that are critical. And there's always going to be people you disagree with. There'll always be right wing, there'll always be liberals. I'm a leftist, and I'm going to have disagreements even with my fellow leftists. The question is, what kind of disagreements will it be? The question is, will it be disagreements that will be cast in such a way that it's still respectful of people across the board, so that you make sure especially vulnerable people are respected, you know?
And how do you ensure that that respect is upheld?
Because the only thing you have is accountability. If there's disrespect, then you make people accountable. All we have is accountability.
What's your definition of democracy?
Democracy is very much like jazz. It's everyday people finding their voices and lifting them collectively in such a way that it shapes their destiny, self-determination, and self-respect tied together.
And what are the main threats that you see to a functioning democracy right now?
Right now, it's capitalism. Right now, it's white supremacy, it's male supremacy, it's homophobia, it's transphobia. And it's, from the United States point of view, it's empire, it's imperialism. All of those are major obstacles that don't allow everyday people to raise their voices in such a way that they can shape their destinies. It's the rule of big money, big military, and really forms of contempt and hate.
What would your definition of free speech be, then?
Well, free speech is, it depends on context, though. You know, anybody who hollers fire in a theater is not expressing free speech in terms of something that's permissible. It depends on what the context is. I think that universities, one context, street corners, another context, TVs, another context. Everybody has it. It needs to have different kind of filters. You don't just have folk expressing hate, trying to reduce free speech to hate speech and trying to conceal their hate in the name of free speech. But at the same time, you do have to allow different people who have a variety of perspectives that you disagree with to be able to express themselves, as long as it's, one, no injurious harm, and two, that it's respectful.
And it seems that people are sort of conflating the two, though, or putting hate speech and free speech into a binary. Shouldn't they be separate?
Well, I think they are different things. I think they are very different things, because free speech is tied in a democracy to a substantive and serious critical dialogue and conversation. Hate speech is a conversation stopper. It doesn't allow for dialogue. It just demeans, dishonors, and dismisses people. And so in that sense, I do not think that they're in any way identical at all. And yet, I don't think you can come up with a general theory. You have to go from case to case and case to case to see whether, in fact, a particular person or a particular kind of dialogue meets the kind of criteria I'm talking about.
And in your book, Democracy Matters, you also talk about escalating authoritarianism, and you have groups of people that are talking about that license to free speech and any kind of opposition to that as being sort of the rise of totalitarianism. How do you combat that?
Well, it's a good question. If that book was written 14 years ago, I had no idea there'd be a wave of neo-fascism all around the world, from the White House on the one hand to Turkey and Hungary and Poland and a whole host of different places, India. So that, I mean, neo-fascism is an attempt to not just stop conversations, but it's an attempt to impose by force, power and coercion, not just the shaping of a society, but to render those who are dissenting illegitimate, throw them in jail or shoot them down like dogs. And so when I talked about escalating authoritarianism 14, 15 years ago, now we've got really, you know, neo-fascists in the making. Many of them in very, very, very powerful positions, and some of them, of course, trying to generate movements. We just had the Klan marching in the States, neo-Nazis marching in the States a year ago and a year later, and they are growing all the time. And so at that point, you're not really talking about even speech. You're just talking about trying to ensure that those who are engaged in full-scale force, coercion, and imposing power need to be rendered accountable.
You spoke on Radio New Zealand about the way you can find people on opposing sides that present well-reasoned arguments, which you've sort of just mentioned, and that, I suppose, Douglas Murray in particular. But more often than not, people are able to get away with making these statements now without a lot of support or not a lot of evidence, simply because it is their right to do so. And they're getting a bigger and bigger platform, I suppose. How do you actually have reasoned discussions when those standards of evidence or peer-reviewed research, for example, aren't adhered to?
Well, usually, though, the right-wing figures are able to in some way get away with what they're saying because they're saying it in the silo, they're saying it in the bubble, they're speaking on their own stations to their own constituencies and audiences. When they are confronted, when they are encountered with accountability and answerability in a dialogue, that puts them in a very, very different situation. I think as long as they're able just to remain isolated and distant from any critical voices at all, or just try to dismiss the critical voices in such a way that they have no weight, then they can get away with it. But when they're right there, face to face, it's a very different situation, especially when you have an audience that's not just their audience, that's not just applauding them, but rather listening attentively and hoping to see some kind of argument and vision put forward. So accountability takes a lot of different forms. There's legal accountability, there's political accountability, there's intellectual accountability. And in the end, that's what democracy is about, is the accountability, especially the powerful, using arbitrary power to dominate, oppress, exploit, and degrade everyday people, working people, poor people, women, black folk, brown folk, yellow folk, indigenous peoples, gays, lesbians, trans, and so forth.
I totally agree in terms of, because when you do put those arguments up against each other, right, they don't stack, and you sort of,
Exactly. Then you do see
it. But in terms of, I'm talking, you know, we're an end of history, quotation marks, era, and neoliberalism especially has also kind of prevented us in questioning things, particularly in the media. So when we're talking about accountability, that often moves a lot slower than sensationalism, for example. If we have Trump, for example, and we have people campaigning for a leave vote in Brexit, where they those groups can pretty much say whatever they want, and then they get the attention, even if it is untrue, then what?
Well, I mean, that's not new. That's been around for a long time. You think about all the lies told about indigenous people. And that cut across ideology, you know what I mean? That wasn't just right-wing folk. That was liberals and even leftists who were deeply racist. So that the issue of accountability is one that is not in any way a present-day reality. It's rooted in something that goes all the way back. That's why a sense of history becomes very important. People can see where these lies have been coming from. What are the forms and iterations that white supremacy has taken? How has it been connected to capitalist development? How has it been connected to settler colonial societies like the United States and like Canada and like Australia, New Zealand, or Israel, or Liberia, and so forth? So the whole issue of the ways in which history is still operating in the present needs to be brought to bear. And that's why conversations and dialogues are so important, because usually history just drops out. And when history drops out, then all you got is just some kind of isolated present, that whoever's reigning at the moment, who has big money and big power, can shape the discourse.
You also in Democracy Matters, and I know it is an older book, but I think it is relevant.
Well, thank you so much. I appreciate that.
You say, we have been, and I think this is in regards to America, we have been unwilling to turn a sufficiently critical eye on our own behaviour in the world. And when you're America, when you've been convinced that you're the bringer of so-called freedom, liberty and equality, does that not make it quite difficult to be self-critical?
Oh, absolutely. That's why it takes tremendous courage to break through the mendacity, to break through all the lies, but not just the lies, but the crimes. The crimes. I mean, America has yet to really acknowledge the degree to which the first crime was in treatment of indigenous peoples. Usually people jump straight to slavery. Slavery was America's original sin. Well, that's already a lie. That's not true. That was a second move that white supremacy made, but the first was indigenous peoples. Well, why would they not want to talk about indigenous peoples? Not simply because indigenous peoples don't count, but because they don't want to look at America as an empire. They just want to look at America as a democracy that has this race deficit. But if you look at America as a democracy that has a race deficit, then you're not going to understand the imperial context in which the United States emerged, in which grew, and why now it is the major empire in deep decay and decline that has far more to do than just issues of race, but has to do with class, it has to do with foreign policies that are tied to corporate interests and tied to geopolitical interests. Those are the kinds of dialogues that people need to be exposed to. That's what can generate the kind of awakening that's needed to deal with these catastrophes that we're dealing with, the ecological ones, the moral ones, the spiritual ones, the political ones, the economic catastrophes of inequality and so on.
And when you do have this sort of, well, not sort of, a very fascist outright coming out of, I mean, they've been there. It's not just suddenly starting. It's just it's coming out into the public.
But more emboldened now.
More emboldened with more strength.
That's right.
And this kind of self-critical eye, you know, how can white supremacists, how can white privilege, something that's been normalized for so long, suddenly become self-aware and let alone self-critical?
Well, one is that you've always had a tradition of white brothers and sisters who are critical of white supremacy. United States, we've got John Brown, we've got Miles Horton. It goes all the way up to Sister Heather herself, the sister who I was just with a year ago, standing right next to her for a few minutes before she was killed, that she was an IWW activist. The IWW was a very strong left-wing organization. She was committed to the humanity of black people. She's committed to struggling against white supremacy, and she gave her life. Well, she's not an isolated incident. There is a tradition of white folk who have been willing to pierce through their privilege and see the truth about their benefits and privilege and call it into question. Now, of course, we could argue it's not enough. Okay, that's not enough. That's true. They got a lot of cousins, and their cousins haven't had their awakening, right? Okay, that's fine. But you have to keep in mind that particular tradition is a significant one, and it's true in the States. I'm sure it's true in New Zealand and in Australia too.
I was speaking to a friend of mine, Annie, who and she was sort of, I guess, quoting Lewis Gordon in the way that, you know, if we engage in open dialogues all the time, is that not putting all our time into trying to dismantle the master's house? And at what point do we turn away from that and from them and start talking about actual fresh ideas to build our own houses?
Well, I think it's a good point. You have to be multi-contextual. You can't spend all your time in dialogue with right-wing folks. This is just one particular moment of an overarching project. You got Black Lives Matter, the Executive Committee, that's all black activists. You got multiracial contexts of socialists that are very important. All of these contexts are crucial, but that doesn't mean that you have no time to engage your right-wing critics, but you don't become obsessed with them. You certainly don't fetishize it. You don't ascribe magical powers to it and think all we need to do is talk with right-wing folk and lo and behold, we're going to change society. No, not at all. We've got to work on a number of different fronts. And in our own lives, we have to be able to move from one context to the next.
I've seen some interviews of yours where you're asked to explain social democracy and why it hasn't worked yet, and you're given a number of failed examples which you have to explain. One of our great thinkers here in Legal Minds and Koro, or Granddad, here in Aotearoa, Moana Jackson, he often talks about the impossible and the imagining of something new or something outside of what we have. What exactly is it that you imagine or hope when you think of the future?
Well, that's a wonderful question, too, because things are so bleak. It's hard enough just to be able to keep resisting and critiquing what's in place, but always in light of something that's grander. And what is grander is far beyond social democracy, is far beyond even democratic socialism, because we got ecological crisis that goes far beyond just modes of production. It has everything to do with trying to generate new ways of life and ways of being in the world that downplay indifference to the vulnerable, that downplay callousness, that downplay mean-spiritedness and cold-heartedness, and create institutions and structures where the priority is really on the most vulnerable. The priority is on poor people. I envision a world with no poverty. I envision a world with less corruption among elites, a world in which there's actually fundamental commitments to women and the gays and lesbians and trans who have been spit on for thousands of years, to push back white supremacy, peoples of color who have been spit on for hundreds of years. So those are all elements that have to do with a kind of utopian vision that seem to be impossible at the moment, but always at work within the real.
Doesn't the empire always rebuild itself?
Not always. Empires come and go. Roman Empire is gone. Ottoman Empire is gone. The Soviet Empire is gone. We got a new Russian one, but that's different than the Soviet one. And the American Empire will come and go, too. The question is what will be its aftermath? What will be its legacy? The Chinese Empire now is very strong and escalating, but it has deep internal decay. So empires come and go. We know that. No doubt about it.
And the power of, I suppose, white supremacy in that, does that not just reform into a new image so that it exists?
Well, it has in the last few hundred years. There's no doubt about that. But the same, but even as empires come and go, they're still connected. The British Empire has come and gone, but the American Empire has certain continuities with it. Some discontinuities, but certain continuities with it. So, yes, white supremacy has been reconstructed and reconfigured since its modern emergence, going back to the slave trade. But it's also been resisted. It's been critiqued. People have been fighting it and pushing back against it. And right now, I mean, we're at a moment where we're just counter-revolution is in the driver's seat. The neo-fascists are growing.
I want to finish on music, as you have a lot to say about music. And there's sort of two parts to this. But first, how do you think music can be a significant tool in this world for getting through difficult times? And how would you explain that to someone who doesn't already know the power of music?
Well, you know, music cuts both ways. Music can be commodified. Music can be used and deployed in such a way that it leads people away from courageous action, away from engaging the world. It could become easily escapist, and that's precisely what corporate elites have tried to do with music, because they understand the power of it. When the power of music is used and deployed on behalf of the people, it becomes one of the most crucial elements in one's self-understanding as an activist, as a visionary, as somebody who is willing to fight, intellectually fight, politically fight, morally and spiritually fight. Why? Because music, in many ways, is probably one of the most elemental and fundamental forces in shaping ourselves as a species. I mean, if artists are the vanguard of the species, musicians are the vanguard of the artists. Music cuts at such a visceral level. It's almost like love in that sense. It cuts at the most profound level of who we are, at the heart, mind, soul, and body. Mm. And few forces in the world cut that deep. And that's precisely why the powers that be are always concerned about the kind of songs that people sing and the kind of music they play, because it can turn things around.
Mm.
That's why Plato banned the flute from the Republic, because he knew people start playing that flute and appealing to things that create a disorder, and he's obsessed with orders. Only the liar he permits in the Republic, but not the flute. He hated the flute. So that's very important.
Yeah. So you talk about Black America having a particular understanding of jazz and blues. How do we make it clear that some people might understand certain things more than others, and that that's not necessarily a bad thing?
Oh, no, we know that's just the way the world is. Some people understand things better than others. It's just a fact. It's just a fact. Very much so. It's It's like saying LeBron is just an ordinary basketball player. Louis Armstrong is just an ordinary trumpet player. Or Muhammad Ali is just an ordinary athlete. No, they were better than others at what they did because of the unbelievable discipline and determination, energy and talent to cultivate the gifts that they had. And that doesn't make them better human beings. It just makes them human beings who are better at doing certain kinds of things. And so it is, that's true in terms of intellectual and spiritual. Malcolm X was just more courageous than most black people. It's just a fact. And so we use him as an example of what it means to be courageous, to tell the truth and speak that truth to power in its face, and to become inspirations in that way. And that's true in every walk of life, of course.
Well, that's all I've got. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. It's been a wonderful dialogue, too.
Thank you. I've really appreciated your time, and all the best for the rest of your tour.
You stay strong now.
Thank you.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.